The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am honored to introduce the Junior Senator from California. Of course, Junior is only a title. There's nothing junior about Barbara Boxer. A member of Congress for more than 30 years, the Senator has written, introduced, or passed legislation that has improved life in this country in measurable ways. From protecting wilderness and water resources to guarding the rights of women, children, the poor, and those leaving the foster care system, to increased funding for Pell Grants, AIDS research, and burn victims, and so much more. You might ask yourself, where did she learn the values and perseverance that made her tough enough to tackle the legislation above? Exactly where you'd expect. Her mother, her father, Ebbets Field, and school. As it happens, her political career actually started more than 60 years ago when she served as the chairman of the Mexican Group, a study group on Mexican arts and culture in her elementary school. The story begins there, but there's a lot that has happened since, as she recounts in her new book, The Art of Tough, Fearlessly Facing Politics and Life. Please welcome Senator Barbara Boxer.
I can see you now. Thank you. So touched by that. I am so grateful that you came out tonight. I would have felt so bad if you didn't. My voice is a little bizarre. I have a little laryngitis. So I've been going all over talking about this book, and it's just been so wonderful. New York, California, Philadelphia, back to Southern California, Seattle, Portland, and on. But tonight, here I am. I'm coming back here for the convention. Isn't that going to be something? Yeah. And talk about the art of tough. This is going to be one tough election. But I have a feeling it's going to end okay. From my point of view, and I have a feeling your point of view. But we could have a few outliers here, which is totally fine with me. One thing I tell people is that I would never have gotten elected if I never picked up about 15 to 17% of the Republican vote. And people are surprised at that, you know. But a lot of my Republican friends in California say, I may not agree with you on every single thing, but you're in it for the right reasons, and you never lead me astray. Tell me how you feel straight from the heart. That's part of the art of tough. Well, let me talk about the book. It took me 3 years to put this book together. I wanted to do two things. The first thing is I wanted to take you, my readers, into the inside of the inside of the inside of the rooms where things happen in the Senate, in the House, in politics, and to show you by sharing these stories, how a bill really becomes a law, or does it? It sounds so easy when we're in school, right? There's a committee, and they hear the bill, and they debate it. They pass it out of the committee, and they have a nice debate. And then it goes to the House. They have another nice debate. They don't talk about what really happens behind the scenes. And so I wanted to take you into those rooms so that you understand who's in those rooms makes a huge difference. And who's left out makes a huge difference. And a lot of times people are purposely left out of those rooms. So I wanted you to see that. And I also wanted to make this kind of an empowerment book because it does take a certain level of toughness to do the work I've done. But I also know it takes a certain level of toughness to do a lot of work. No matter what you do, or even to be part of a family, or even, you know, be part of a community, or on a nonprofit board, whatever it is, there will be people that will try to silence you. And I'm sure you've all had it in your life. Why are you saying this? That's dumb. Why are you the only one in the room speaking up? Well, what I want to do in this book is lay out the 9 rules of the art of tough. And I am not going to tell you all 9 because I want you to buy the book. But I'll tell you a couple. So the first thing I do in the book, because, you know, it's kind of audacious to say the art of tough and I'm standing in the book, you know, kind of. But I wanted to prove why I've had to be tough. So right in the beginning, I'll read you a couple of pages here. This is the beginning. By the way, the preface is written by Kirsten Gillibrand. How many of you know who she is? She's a senator from New York. She's quite wonderful. And one of the reasons I feel I can leave the Senate, I'm not running again, because people like Kirsten can just take up the banner. But she writes a beautiful prelude here. But this is my writing. I'm no martial artist or big-time, high-stakes moneymaker. I barely measure 5 feet, maybe 5'3" in my heels. And nobody has ever accused me of having a menacing presence. No, but I have lived with an emotional intensity, a sense of indignation, determination, and sometimes outrage that has often inspired opposing reactions among my political colleagues, voters, and right-wing pundits who have said these and other quotable things about me. This is one. Barbara Boxer is a great candidate for the Democratic Party, female and learning disabled. That's Ann Coulter. How's this one? Barbara Boxer continues to prove that she is unfit for any office higher than turd inspector. That's another one. It's a lovely life I've chosen. But this one I have to tell you because this takes the cake. I have so many of these. Unfortunately, here's this one. In the future, Barbara Boxer may be remembered as the Frau Dr. Mengele of the U.S. Senate. And then just in case people don't know who Dr. Mengele was, he goes on and he says, Dr. Joseph Mengele, the Nazi war criminal who directed merciless human experiments, may have decided to come back as a woman. Yeah, this is a guy named Michael Savage, and he has a radio show in my great state. This is just why people would come up to me all the time. They hear all this. They read all this. I haven't even gone through some of the... I can't even read some of these. And they say, how can you stand it? How did you get so tough? And in the beginning, I used to say, I'm not tough. You know, I grew up like an ordinary kid. And I'm not... It doesn't bother me. And then when I sat down and I put this all together, I realized, you know, I think I've been tough. And I think I should explain how I got that way. So that's part of the fun of the book. One of the rules of the art of tough came from an experience I had as a kid that I'll share with you, but I won't read it. I write it better than I'll tell it, but I'll tell it. When I was about, I'd say 10, do you remember, I say to the women here, who are kind of a little gray, maybe, or maybe blonde now. Do you remember when we were kids, how the boys would chase us around, say, chase you and pull your hair or do it? So this one kid was picking on me, I think because I was always very little, and he was little, so I was the perfect marker. So Albert was always in my face. And one day he just crossed the line. My 10-year-old line. He kind of gave me one of those punches you do like this in the shoulder and said something about my hair or something. People pick on my hair a lot. Say so something. I'll remind you why I said that. And I just was over the top. So it was very quiet in the hall. No one was watching. I took out my number two pencil, lead, and I stabbed him in the arm where you get your vaccination. Now, the minute I did it, I started to cry because I knew, oh, my God, what? And he cried. I cried because I lost it and I knew it. He cried because he deserved it and he knew it. So now it's our secret, you know. We just part ways. Everything's fine. So the next day I started to suffer the anguish of acting out of anger. He's not in school. Okay, no, okay. Second day, not in school. Now, in my neighborhood, we only had Irish, Italian, and Jews. I never met a WASP until I met Pete Stark, my colleague from Northern California. And when I went up to him, I said, thank God, Pete, I finally met a WASP. He said to me, I'm a Unitarian. So I guess I still haven't met a real one. So now I'm walking down this lot on the way home. I lived in the inner city of Brooklyn. This lot, and he lived in a little house. And the third day, he's been absent. There's a black crepe cloth over the house. Now I definitely knew I killed him. I'm freaking out. And of course, now I must go tell my mother. And she looks at me, she says, what's wrong, Barbara Sue, which is what she said when she knew something was going on. What's wrong, Barbara Sue? I tell her, oh, my God, how could you even do this? This is outrageous. You don't do this. And Daddy and I taught you, you don't use violence. You don't. Why didn't you tell me? I would have complained. I would have gone to the principal. She's, you know, giving me the whole I am out of my mind. She says, but I don't think you killed him. She said, I'm going to call the principal. So she calls the principal. Principal says, Mrs. Levy, that was my maiden name. She says, Albert's fine, but his grandpa died. Oh. I felt bad that I felt so good that it wasn't him. It was terrible. It was his grandfather. But when he came back, I hugged him. And I learned a lesson. From that experience, the anguish of acting out of anger and doing something you truly regret. It could be you say something. Look, we've all done it. And you have to take a step back. Because one of these people who say these things to me, you know, I can't take out a lead pencil and stab him in the arm. I got to figure out how to use my brain. Well, my mother, in closing off this rule of the art of tough, don't act out of anger, she said to me, honey, I want to tell you something. She said, you can learn, and I'm going to use an off-color word here, so excuse me, not senatorial. She said, honey, you can learn how to tell someone to go to hell, but if you say it in the right way and in a nice way, they will say thank you. And I think that's been doing all my life on the Senate floor. The gentleman doesn't understand that if he does this policy, it may wind up ruining the world, you know, but very kind. I understand where he's coming from. I get it, but it just doesn't make sense. So you can learn how to do these things. So that's the first lesson of the art of tough. One of the other lessons of the art of tough is to keep your sense of humor. You could tell I have one. You have to. I don't care what you do in your life. And I wound up loving to write funny lyrics to songs. And it was a way to get out my feelings and try to win the day. So here's the story. When I got to the House of Representatives in 1982, imagine, 82, I was sworn in 83, I come from California. We had a workout sensibility. So I asked, where was the gym? And they said, well, the guys have a gym, and the women have a gym, very small. I said, okay, that's fine. And I go over to look at it. It's a not quite half the size of the stage is the gym. And it has 5 hair dryers, all with the big, you know, the old kind you do. Because why else would a woman want a gym? Just to wash her hair, put rollers in it, and dry. So I was a bit offended. So I go to the House Administration Committee. Tip had appointed these people, Tip O'Neill, and I said, Eddie Bolin, this is crazy. We need to use the gym. He said, oh, no. No, no, no. By then, we had 23 women and out of 435. Pat Schroeder was one of them. Barbara Mikulski, Jerry Ferraro, Olympia Snow, Barbara Cannelli. So I thought, okay, we will try to use this women's gym. So I called my friend Claudette, who's an aerobics teacher. Very good. Claudette, you need to fly out here. We're going to have an aerobics lesson. We get the music. The 6 of us are here. We line up. She said, put your arms out to the side. Well, we touched each other's hands. So she says, okay, 3 of you go a second line. That's fine. Put your arms in the air, okay? And then she says, now take your arms. And the music is, put your hands on your hips. And with that, Mikulski says, Barbara Mikulski, if I could find my hips, I wouldn't be here. That was the end. Everyone cracked up. So we couldn't get in the gym. So I decided I would write a song. I'm going to attempt to sing this little jingle to you, given this nightmare. But it's worth it. I think it's funny. So I wrote these words to 5'2" Eyes of Blue. And I got 2 other colleagues to sing it, Mary Rose Okar and Marcy Kaptur from Ohio. And I got a guitar. So we sang it to the Democratic whip, Tony Coelho. He said, you know, this could work. This could work. He says, if I like this song, then you should sing it to Tip O'Neill and the committee. Okay. So remember, don't act out of anger. If I'd walked in there and said, are you kidding me? You know, women have just, we have to work out. Our heart has to pump. God forbid. We were smiling. So we sang this song, went like this. This is going to be tough. I may have to just say the words. Exercise, glamorize. Where to go will you advise? Can't everybody use your gym? Equal rights. We'll wear tights. Let's avoid those macho fights. Can't everybody use your gym? Now, if you run into a colleague who looks sad and blue, she'll fight and fuss. She'll even cuss. You bet your life it could be us. 'Cause we're not slim. We're not trim. Can't we make it hers and him? Can't everybody use your gym? We're only asking. Help me. Can't everybody use your gym? We got into the gym. Oh, God. This is not good. Thanks for putting up with that. But in truth, I wrote a lot of songs about a lot of things. This was the only one where we changed a policy, unfortunately. For example, I wrote, don't cry for me, Condoleezza. You are the one who told us of tubes, aluminum, of weapons there were none. Your truth was half-baked like yellow fake cake. Didn't work. And on the serious side, I write in the book about how painful that war was for me. And how I stood with 23 others and voted no, and it was really unpopular. But I knew in my heart what would happen, sadly. And all you had to do was read the history, and you knew what was going to happen. It was going to be a religious civil war and start of the flames, still burning. And so every day for 8 years, I actually carried it in my heart. And I write, you know, my biggest regret, no matter what I did. Songs, talks, TV, radio, op-eds, everything. I couldn't. end it, it took Barack Obama finally, when we elected him, the thing would still be going on if McCain had won that race. I believe this. I know this. I know this. We're there. We're no longer in a combat mission. So that was something. I want to tell you another serious story about Anita Hill. Where's my guiding light here? Where is he? He's going to tell me when. Oh, how many more minutes? Okay. Good. I'm going to tell you a story you know, but you don't know it this way. Yes, someone like me, we have egos, of course. We're in this business. We have egos. We've got to believe in ourselves. We've got to be brave and tell people why they should vote for us. So it's hard to admit when you make a mistake. And I made one that I write about in the book. When I was running for the Senate in the 92 election, in 91, Anita Hill came forward during the Clarence Thomas hearings, and she told her story of being harassed. And I was in the House then with Pat Schroeder and these other people I told you about, Nita Lowey, some others. And when I heard this, I knew they had to reopen those hearings. And all the women in the House, there's so few of us, said, you've got to reopen the hearings and look at these charges. Now, the status was that they had just defeated Bork. So this was George Herbert Walker's next one, Clarence Thomas. And the committee under Joe Biden wanted to get it over with, get it done. And when this happened, it was earth-shattering. And so when I got back to D.C., the women of the House said, we're going to make a statement, and we'll divide up into a couple of groups. Half will go to the Senate steps, march up the Senate steps. You know that picture of the women? How many of you know what I'm talking about? The picture of the women, it's in the book. I had to pay a lot of money for it, for the rights. So you should see that picture. But that picture tells the story. You know how a picture's worth 1,000 words? You can look at us. You could look at us. You could see the anger, the determination, the focus, the energy. And half of us went up the steps, the other half made speeches on the House floor, calling on the Senate to reopen the hearings. So I'm in the group that's running up the stairs. This was all Schroeder's idea, Pat Schroeder. But I'm the athlete in the group because I come from California. So I'm first up the steps, boom. And everybody said, Barbara Boxer's leading the women up the steps. I felt bad because the rest were going, ha, ha. But California. So we get to the top of the steps. The senators are meeting inside. And we knock on the door. Woman opens up. Imagine this. All the Democratic senators are eating lunch. We're outside the door. These women members. And we say, we need to come in and speak to the senators and tell them they have to open up the hearings and listen to Anita Hill's testimony. The woman says, you can't come in. Well, why can't we? She says, we don't let strangers in the Senate. We said, what are you talking about? You know, we're serving in the House. We're not strangers. We've got 110 years of experience between us. She says, oh, don't take offense. It's not, it's a term of art. Anyone who's not a senator is a stranger. First of all, that was such baloney, because I'm a senator. We never say that. So that's what came to her mind. So we look at each other, and the art of tough kicked in. And I said to her, come here a minute. So she comes out. But look down the steps. What do you see? She says, I see about 50 cameras down there, for 35, 40, 50 cameras. I said, yeah, they saw us go up. They know why we came up. If we turn around and go down there without having met the senators, we're going to tell them that you did not want to hear from us. She says, come right in. But we didn't come in. We went to a side door where George Mitchell, who was the leader, met with us. He said, okay, we'll open up the hearings. I was so ecstatic. This is where my mistake came in. After that happened, we all, including me, we took our eye off the ball because we were so positive that because Anita Hill was so articulate, so professional, so wonderful, that would be the end when she told her story. So this is what I write in the book. I blame myself for not focusing more on what was happening behind the scenes after we marched up the steps of the Senate. I might have learned in real time what I learned later, that the committee had refused to allow the testimony of two women, Angela Wright and Rose Jourdain, both of whom were prepared to say that Thomas had made unsolicited sexual advances. Wright, who'd worked for Thomas in the EEOC until he fired her, said he pressured her for dates, asked about the size of her breasts, made similar comments about other women. Jourdain also said Thomas was always commenting on her body. Then in May of 93, an article in The New Yorker by Jane Mayer and Jill Abramson stated that Joe Biden had abdicated control of the Thomas confirmation hearings and didn't call four women, who had traveled to Washington to corroborate Anita Hill's claims. They also would have said that Thomas lied under oath, since they had seen video rental records showing his interest in the use of pornography to a far greater extent than the public had been led to believe. They wrote a book. It was called The Selling of Clarence Thomas, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. Looking back, I failed to do the follow-through. I failed big time. Not that it would have been easy. We women of the House were seen as the enemy we really were. Enemies of the status quo, of the way things were, of the gentlemanly way things were. I believe that even my buddy Joe Biden had to succumb to the vast majority of his committee members on both sides. It's a long, sad story. And there's even more. In 2010, Clarence Thomas's wife, Virginia, left a voicemail message on Anita Hill's office phone at Brandeis over a weekend, demanding that the professor say she was sorry. Quote, "I would love you to consider an apology sometime and some full explanation of why you did what you did," the voicemail said, according to NBC News. And she went on and said, "So give it some thought and certainly pray about this and come to understand why you did what you did." That was Clarence Thomas's wife. And then I write, "Incredible, isn't it? Professor Hill called the message inappropriate and reported it to her employer's security department, who in turn reported it to the FBI. Further, Professor Hill said she had no reason to atone." And this is Anita's quote. "I have no intention of apologizing because I testified truthfully about my experience, and I stand by that testimony," she said in a statement to NBC News. And then I finish this piece. "Anita Hill's story touched the hearts of women and caring men across the nation. I definitely rode that wave. It was a rough wave and very high. But I hope you can understand now why the Anita Hill case translated into victories for women. Anita Hill is an icon who went through hell for coming forward, and I hope she knows what a difference she made, even though Clarence Thomas got confirmed. Major federal laws were passed to address sexual harassment and violence against women, and the long march to get more women elected to Congress was kicked into high gear, all because of Anita's courage, her ability to be tough under extraordinary pressure. I was one of those women who benefited from her particular art of tough." That's that part. Right? So, as they say in the Senate, I could go on and on, but it's your turn now.
Do you think we're going to see the first woman president? And if not, what are the rest of us going to do?
I'm going to go way out on a limb. We are going to celebrate the 100th year of women getting the right to vote in 2020. There will be a woman in the White House. Because we're going to elect her in 2016.
Senator, thank you for your service. Thank you for the things that our introduction talked about. As you talk about tough, and the campaign coming up is likely to be tough as an understatement, if Secretary Clinton were standing here and you were going to give her some advice on how to handle tough, what would you advise her? How do you think this campaign can be turned around from name-calling and all these innuendos to a discussion, perhaps, of what the country really needs?
Right.
Is that still possible?
Of course. Let me say this. I don't think we have to teach Hillary how to be tough. Honest to God, this woman has gone through so much. Everyone's tried to tear her down from the beginning of time. And as she says, I'm still standing. She knows how to be tough. So I'm the last one. But I will say this. You know how people say, but they say to me, you're so authentic and Hillary's not authentic. No, it's not true. I'm authentic. I'm from Brooklyn. This is my life. So is Bernie. I can't see Hillary saying, it's going to be huge. It's not her. Her authenticity is Midwest authenticity. Her authenticity is being a policy wonk and working for us. She's a workhorse, not a show horse. She's not good at giant rallies. She's good just talking to a small group because she's interested in getting things done. When Hillary came into the Senate, remember, she was first lady. Then she ran for the Senate from New York. Now, you're very close to New York. You go through that gauntlet. Talk about needing to be tough. Their whole goal is to destroy you, the press. It's just equal opportunity destroyers. They don't care who you are. She knows how to deal with it. She will take the high road. She's going to not be afraid to say the things, to talk about who Donald Trump, who he's insulted, two-thirds of the country. And, you know, frankly, if everyone he's insulted votes for her, she'll win in a landslide. Hispanics, Muslims, right? Disabled people, veterans, Hispanics, women, big time. That's more than half the country right there. So I just think it's going to be okay. And I think her authenticity is that she is this. She doesn't backslap. This is not her way. And I think we have to start saying she's authentically a caring human being who wants us to work for us. She'd rather be with the light on at night in the Oval figuring it out and getting it done and calling legislators in. So I think we should take that quote-unquote negative that people say. She's not authentic. She is authentic. Hillary is Hillary, and she's not going to become a cheerleader with pom-poms or, you know, she's not going to be Barbara Boxer or, you know, she didn't grow up in Brooklyn like I did. She's different. She's waspy. Finally, I met one I adore. Anyway, who else?
Right here in the third row.
Thank you, Senator, for coming. I really enjoyed listening to you. What are your plans for the future now?
Okay. See this book that you're going to buy, maybe, I hope, and we could take a picture together. I'm going to go all over the country talking about my book. And I think when I leave, I'm going to do some spinoffs from my book. I don't know yet, because I can't really pursue these things while I'm still in the Senate. But you know Chris Matthews? I love Chris. Chris used to work for Tip O'Neill. He wrote the book Hardball. He has a show called Hardball. And I think there's a lot in this. I could talk about other people who've had to be tough, and I could interview them. I could do a lot of things. I'm going to keep my pack because I know how critical it is to raise money. I hate it. I can't stand doing it for myself. I am the only candidate that when I was dialing for dollars, I had to raise $40 million for my last race. And I had my fundraisers. They were three of them. It was like a phone bank. You'd go off the hill. They dial. And I'd say, oh, I pray it goes to the voicemail. So I didn't have to really say something. So now I'd say, hi, I hope you're fine. We're fine. Can you come to my next event? Call my fundraising person at this number. Because I was so humiliated asking for money for myself. But I don't mind doing it. So while we're trying to get the big money out of politics, I'm not going to just walk away from my colleagues. We need to take back the Senate. We need to take back the House. It's just a mess. We've got people who say there's no climate change. Can you imagine? 98% of the scientists tell us this planet's in major trouble. And my colleagues on the Republican side say, I don't know. I'm not a scientist. Well, clearly you're not. And that's why you should listen to the 98% of them. And then I go on and I say, if you went to a doctor and he said you had this giant tumor and it looked really bad and had to come out, are you going to say, I don't know. I'm not a doctor. No. Maybe I'll go into stand-up comedy. You would say, I want a second opinion, a third, a fourth, a fifth. Probably you might go to 10 doctors. If I would say, if 98% of the doctors said, take it out, you take it out. So they have lost it on this. And the sad thing is, when I started, the environment was such a bipartisan issue. And so was a woman's right to choose was a bipartisan issue. George Herbert Walker Bush was on the board of Planned Parenthood. And then when he ran for president, he suddenly forgot all that. So it's changed. But that was a long answer to a short question. I don't know exactly what I'm going to do, but I am going to have fun.
Lady in turquoise here on our right.
Hi. Well, I'm going to take you back to Brooklyn. I'm over here, right here. Here. Other side. I'm going to take you back to Brooklyn, where I grew up with you in Crown Heights and went to PS 161.
Oh, my God.
And I believe you graduated a year ahead of me. And what I found was actually something that goes with this, with the book, but I found a quote that I wanted to ask you about. You said, the fight is worth making, Boxer said, citing her formative days at Brooklyn's public school, 161, I'm a fighter.
My God, and that when did was, I say that?
I don't know, but I found it. I found it online. And so I wanted to ask you what you thought about 161 that, you know, that made you learn to fight. Maybe me too, fight for what you believe in.
Well, I gave you the story of Albert. And I also gave you the story of Jackie Robinson, you know. I lived six blocks from Ibbets Field, and my father used to take me to the baseball games, and he taught me about civil rights. Because he said, honey, when Jackie Robinson gets up to the plate, some people are going to boo, and they're going to say horrible things. Why? I said, he is my favorite player, the way he stands with his pigeon toes, ready to steal. He said, because of the color of his skin. Said, well, you know, that's ridiculous. And I learned about racism through my introduction, through Jackie Robinson. And then when my mother, it's all in the book. But they're great stories. I went to Miami in 1950 because my mother was sick, and in those years, if you were sick, you lay in the sun. Today, you need layers of stuff. She lay in the sun. She got better. She says, let's go on the bus. Let's go to the movies. Okay. So we get in the bus. I read this at the Jewish Community Center in Washington, D.C., and I cried when I read it, so I'm better off just telling it. And we get in the bus. My mother never graduated from high school because her family needed her to go to work. Her father was very ill, and so she didn't have a high school degree. She was the smartest person. And my dad, she supported him. He went to school at night, law school at night. So there I am with her. And we go on the bus, and I'm sitting in the bus, And an African-American woman comes on the bus. It's very crowded. She's older. She must have been like 50. So I jump up to offer her my seat. She says, no, thank you. And I said, my mother. I said, please, because I was taught. I said, Mommy, what? That woman is not very nice. She won't take my seat. And my mother whispers, she says, this is segregation. And she has to go and sit in the back of the bus. And, you know, I'm 10. And I said, what? That's ridiculous. And I'm upset. And my mother's, there's my mother away from my dad. And she gets the moment. So she says, come on, let's go to the back. So we go to the back. And there's no seats. And we're standing by the pole. And I'm very bemused. I don't get it, and I'm looking around, and the woman is not making eye contact with me, and my mother knows I'm really, really confused, and she rubs my back of my neck, and she says, I know this is wrong, but this is how it is in the South. And then the woman gets off the bus, and we just nod, she didn't say anything. And later, when I sat down to write this book, and one of the rules of The Art of Tough is you fight against racism and prejudice whenever you see it, and I tell the story. And I write, my mother never lived to see me meet Rosa Parks, who got rid of all the bus craziness. My mother lived to see me when I carried the Congressional Medal of Honor for Jackie Robinson. She never got into my Senate office where I have a big photograph of Jackie running the bases. And I said, I wonder if she knew at that moment that she would teach me something that would stay in my heart forever. And I have a feeling she did. Yeah. Thank you.
Gentleman in the fourth row in the blue, and then there's a fella in back
but
here on your right.
But that's what PS-161 taught me.
I would tell you that you are in the city where our hero is a fictional boxer. But Sylvester Stallone made millions of dollars because his boxer was resilient. And so I'm wondering, in your career, was there a time when something went so wrong, was so bad, and you got so low, and you got past that, and how did you have the resilience to do that?
Oh, my God. Yes. There was a moment that I talk about in the book where... Oh, God, how do I make it so fast? While I was in the House, they had the House Bank scandal. And I will tell you what the House Bank scandal was. They had a House Bank. It really wasn't a bank. It was like a payroll office. So I signed up as soon as I got my check, and we all got in trouble for this. They would put the check right in. So if you got paid on the 1st, I never looked at anything. I assumed I get credited on the 1st, so I write all my bills, whatever they were. So it turned out you didn't get credit till the 5th. So between the 1st and the 5th, you got automatic overdraft protection. They never told you. You never paid for it. It was a scandal. And people, they had me. I was running for the Senate. They had me bouncing all over the screen. Barbara Bouncer, boing, 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 with a dunce cap on. I'm telling you, it was awful. And the press was following me around. How many checks did you bounce? Show me your checks. I said, I'm not showing you my checks. You're not going to see how much I spend at the cleaners or at Macy's. Get lost. That made the press really mad. So I decided, enough. I'm dropping out. And this was about March, before the June primary. The Art of Tough left me. I was that down, so I thought, this is humiliating, it's embarrassing. And I tried everything to talk my way out of it. I said, it's true. I don't spend enough time on my child. I didn't try to defend it. I just said, I have good things and bad things about me. You could take, in those days, we didn't have computers. Take a line and draw it down the center of a yellow pad and write good things about Barbara Boxer and bad things about. And on the good thing, she got the first after-school program. She, you know, put Acres and Wilderness. Write all the things I've ever done. And on the other side, say, she's terrible with her checkbook. And her closets are messy, too. So I tried that. Wasn't good. So things were really awful. So you're not, when I tell you this, you will not believe it. So you have to trust me that I couldn't make this up. It's too sweet. And I never go there. It's soupy sweet. So I call my husband, who, by the way, I never expected, first of all, to win the primary anyway, but things were going well at that point, except this thing. So I tell my husband, you'll be happy to know I'm dropping out. He said, you are? I said, yeah, why? I can't stand it anymore. It's humiliating. I don't need this in my life. Just the things you said. I can do other things. I'm bouncing all over the screen. I don't want the kids to see that. I got to have something else I could do. And he said, all right, it's fine. When are you coming home? He says, don't do anything. Just come home. We'll talk about it. We'll figure out a way. He said, I'll be home at 6 or whatever it was. So I won't go into all the detail, but I walk into the house, and Stu says, I'm upstairs watching the baseball game, and the kids are downstairs. Well, my kids already, one was working, one was in college. They didn't live with us. What are they doing there? They call me in the room. My daughter, she says, Nicole, she said, Mom, you cannot drop out. She says, what will it say to the women? Hardly many women ever do this. And now you're going to run because it gets tough and you can't do it. And my son says, and they always argue. He says, Nicole's right. Oh, boy. Nicole's right. Two against one. I couldn't divide them. She's right, Mom. So what if you don't make it? You have to keep your chin on, heads up. So then they say, sit down. I mean, this is so soupy. They come out with a Dr. Seuss book, Oh, the Places You'll Go, which I always read them when they were kids and they were crying because something bad happened. You'll go for the top, but you may not reach it. And if you reach the top, but then you won't. And then you'll go down, but you have to try again because if you go higher, then you may make it. And the book goes through. I said, okay, enough. I stayed in it. We said, we'll stay in it. We'll do our best. And we won big in the primary. So, but that was such a great question because that was the time when the art of tough just simply came out of my body and left me. And my kids were there to put it back together, which I'll close. I think we should close. A few more minutes. Okay, my voice, okay. With one rule of the art of tough, another rule. You need love in your life. And that sounds counterintuitive. Find love. That's an art of tough. You bet. Because if you don't have people in your life who love you, it doesn't have to be a spouse, kids. It could be a friend. It could be a teacher. It could be anyone that you care about. They really care about you. There's no other agenda. If you don't have that, you won't make it. And I tell a story about someone, some kid that I thought I loved. He didn't really love him, and he didn't really love me, and I figured out my mother came to the rescue. The fact is, you need people around you who care about you so much that they will give you the unvarnished truth. And if you're wrong, they'll say it, but they'll back you anyway. So thank you for the question. It took me back to quite an experience.
Senator Boxer, I'm wondering what you observe about the change that needed to happen in being tough in the Senate and the House when the Rove Cheney administration came in, when we went from a Democratic-led Clinton administration.
The Rove Cheney administration.
That's what I call it, yeah. Wait, my Republican staff friends, and we got along very well with Republicans and Democrats, mm-hmm. as soon as that administration came in, told me that the word came down, stop dealing productively with the Democratic staff. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if I've never had a chance to ask anyone that would know. What did you see about how affairs across the aisle changed at that time?
It's been getting worse. I can't say that it changed at that moment. It's been getting worse because the parties have moved so far apart. I told you before, when I started out, the Republicans were the biggest conservationists. They were pro-choice and all the rest. And all of a sudden, what happened? So I can't say that that's to blame. This has been happening. I would say it's because of money in politics, because the polluter money has gone to the right, you know, side of the aisle. And people who said there was climate change, like John McCain, now say no. You know, it's unreal. And they just say no, it's not happening, even though they thought it was happening 5 years ago. They don't want to be primaried. So I think there's a real reason why this happened. Parties have grown apart. And until people are elected who, you know, frankly, are reasonable and who are caring and are in it for the right reasons, it's very hard. Now, through it all, I've been able to get a lot done. I'm very proud. In my book, even though it's boring, I list my 50 top accomplishments. The reason I do it is I don't want you to think I was just there having all these experiences and not, didn't do anything. I got 1,000 things done. And even during W's time, I was able to get acres and acres into wilderness, even though W said he'd never sign one more acre of wilderness. He did, because he wanted something else, and I wasn't about to let that happen until I got my wilderness. So when you learn the art of tough and you learn how to get around it, you can. But it is a sad state of affairs. And now with this situation, I don't know where we're going. All I know is we have to save the country and elect Hillary Clinton, because this other thing is the most frightening thing. I mean, you know, when somebody says, we want to make America great, and he doesn't understand what makes America great, is that we work together. I don't know how many of you here are watching my Golden State Warriors, who had a lousy night last night. Yeah, but their team, their slogan is strength in numbers, because they pass the ball, and everybody's involved, and they have a second team and a third team, and everybody plays, everybody's involved, everybody's respected. And when one guy's down and he can't make a three-pointer, somebody else does it. That's what America's about. And the fact that we would have somebody try to divide us, you know, I don't want insulter-in-chief. I don't want divider-in-chief. This is the United States of America. So the parties have grown apart, and now we're even further splintered.
Barbara, do you want to do one more?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Off to our left here.
Hello. I'm here with my coworkers, and so I'm going to ask this question on behalf of all of them. We work for a women's organization where we primarily work with female college students, and we are, I think, pretty young ourselves, starting out in the workplace and trying to master the art of tough and on that journey. Do you have any advice for us as we are trying to also empower young women in their 18 and 19-year-old to master the art of tough while we're still trying to figure it out ourselves?
The art of tough. You got it. 9 rules. And I will tell you right now, you'll get a kick out of those rules. Again, some of them are counterintuitive. Another one, forgive. I'll tell you a story, and we'll end on this one, and then I'll meet you, and we'll take pictures and do the rest. Forgive. It's really hard sometimes to forgive. For example, I had a horrible run-in with Mitch McConnell 20 years ago. It is outlined in this book in all its gory detail. Honestly, Mitch McConnell and I did not talk for 20 years. Because as I write in The Art of Tough, if somebody has broken your heart and really broken your heart and really done the wrong thing, you got to put them in a special place. Yeah, you say, hi, how are you, bye. But they don't get let in. They don't get let in. So last year, it became evident that if Mitch McConnell and I didn't get together, we would lose the entire Highway Trust Fund, which funds all the bridge repairs, all the street repairs, all the transit systems, and so on. And so, guess what? After 20 years of never working on anything, we worked together. And we got it done. It was hilarious in a way, because we had such opinions of each other. And when we actually got down to do this work, he comes from a different type of tough than my tough. But it was tough versus tough. And we got it done. And we were so shocked that we actually got it done. There was enough in it for him and enough in it for me, as a good bill, that we went out to dinner. Oh, my God. I don't know whose reputation was ruined, his or mine. Because we, you know, everyone was looking, why are they having dinner? I gave him a tie that had bridges all over it. And he gave me a Kentucky Slugger baseball bat. So when you read this, I think you'll agree that I was right to shut it off for that, because of the essence of what he did. Now, interestingly, he wrote a book that just came out. It's called The Long Game. And he writes about the same incident, which has to do with Robert Packwood. Anyone remember that? And he has a very different memory. But as you can tell, everything I write in this book, I back up with contemporaneous articles. So when I told somebody the other day, buy both books and then decide who to believe on that pack. Anyway, can I just say, and just thank you so much for coming out, that I was here about 12 years ago, and I wrote, I think it was my first novel, which was really fun. But you know what? This is way more fun, because this is real. And I want to leave you with this idea. I think people don't give themselves enough credit for their own lives and how interesting your life is. You kind of take it for granted, and I sort of took mine for granted till I sat down over this period. And I strongly recommend, you've got stories from PS161. People, you have stories that go back. You don't want to lose the stories. You don't want to lose the stories for your kids, for your grandkids, for yourself. And I strongly recommend you considering it. I dedicated this book to my parents, to my husband and my children and my grandchildren, but also to a friend of mine who I lost to cancer, who was the most extraordinarily beautiful younger woman. I think she died at 60. And she knew I was writing the book, because I told you it was a 3-year project. And she said, you know, Barbara, I don't even think I could, and I write this in the book. She said, I don't even think I could write an article about my life. And I looked at her, and I said, Paula, I could write a movie about your life. You're beautiful. You went out, left home early. She was from a very ethnic family. You went out. You found your way. You became one of the first women in this particular company. You made yourself self-made. You fell in love at 50. I said, you fought cancer. That was the time when she had fought it back. And she looked at me and she said, you really think so? Yeah, I do. So I hope you'll read this book and think about your own lives and realize, don't lose the stories. Don't lose the memories. Don't lose the lessons. And I hope that you'll find, regardless of what stage of life you're in, that these rules and the way I learned them will have some meaning in your life. Thank you so very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.